This is URN Sport.
Welcome to the Tuesday Sports Show.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for listening to the URN Sport on this Tuesday evening. We will be discussing over the next hour all the sports news from the past week and previewing what's to come over the next 7 days.
Murray wins! Murray wins it all! This is going to be a top break. The Cubs win the World Series! Barrett control this, and the Cup is his. He's coming after him. He's immortal now. Usain's done it.
Here's Jordan with three. Yes! A spectacular move by Michael Jordan.
This is URN Sport.
Hello and welcome to this Tuesday Sports Show, our second sports show of the year, our second Tuesday Sports Show of the year. I'm your host, Jeremy Dunn. I am joined in the studio by Rory, Callum and Matt. And over the next hour, we're going to be bringing you all the latest sports news that's been going on and some topics of discussion. We've got a chat about the issue of racism in cricket, the new proposals for selections in rugby, as well as mental health in sports, specifically in athletics. So like we said, we've got a long show ahead of us. If you're interested in getting involved, then do drop us a web text at www.urn1350.net. That's www.urn1350.net. But we're going to start things off then with a story from the cricketing world. Matt, I'm going to throw things over for you then to start things off. So it's an issue regarding potential racism in cricket, which isn't something we usually hear about.
No, it's not usually seen as being a big issue in cricket, but it's come to our attention as the Australian batsman Usman Khawaja, the first Muslim to play Test cricket for Australia, has written an article on the Player's Voice website about the difficulties he faced as a Pakistan-born Australian growing up playing cricket in Australia, and the amount of sledging and abuse he got about his heritage, and how difficult it was for him to make it through the ranks. And for me, this raises two issues in the world of cricket. One, the actual racism that comes through sledging, which we obviously say is deplorable and disgusting, and then also the issue of whether potential cricketers are missing out on the ability to play for their countries because of the lack of opportunities at club and grade cricket across the world. So Australia have clearly got an issue with this, because Khawaja is essentially the only Muslim to play for Australia. In a country that is admittedly mostly white, they have failed to produce many Muslim cricketers. The only other notable cricketer is Fawad Ahmed, who was actually emigrated from Pakistan when he was 30, so he's not really an Australian product. So that raises questions about their system. And Australia have got a bit of a history of racism in grade cricket and international, especially against South Africans, with people being banned from matches in 2013 and 2005 for racism against players like Makia Nantini, who's the South African fast bowler, and Hashim Amla. So it's obviously an issue that Australian cricket is facing at the moment.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird thing, actually, when we come to talking about, because obviously sledging, it's part and parcel sometimes with the game in terms of, you know, any batsman that goes up to the crease, you will always have you slip and your wicky, usually sort of making a few smart-ass comments.
There's that line that you've got to be really careful about crossing.
That's the key thing. You've got to know where the line is and what's across it. And obviously, racism is. I mean, the thing with Australia not producing many Muslim cricketers is that whilst it's a relatively diverse country, Muslims are a new arrival. So seeing these sort of, we would only now be seeing Muslim cricketers actually coming through if they were having a good time essentially in the coming up through the ranks without being essentially put off the game by racist sledging. And the thing with countries when it comes to racism against any particular group is it takes a while. It takes people who have been raised with people of that race. You can see it in elections across Europe, even with the Brexit election here, Brexit referendum here in the recent general election, the correlation of essentially anti-immigrant sentiment with the number of immigrants who are actually in the area is very strongly inverse. So the more immigrants you have, the more willing people are to accept them. So that's the almost problem. That is unfortunately almost a matter of time for Muslims in Australian cricket.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about Australian society. Definitely, having actually lived in Australia for 6-7 months myself, there isn't that kind of knowledge, or people aren't used to having Muslims living in their society. But I think kind of looking at the article, and one of the big things, the problem probably isn't at the top. It's not in the professional game. You can't get away with racism in the professional game anymore with stump mic and things like that. Like, you're going to get caught and you're going to get sanctioned. It's in grade cricket. It's in the lower levels. It's the people who are turning out on a Saturday and a Sunday. That's where it can still go on. That's where it can still not get caught. That's also where potentially players could be thought, well, I don't want to play this game anymore if I'm going to get racially abused every Saturday and every Sunday. So I think that's where the kind of key issues lie. It's not at the top. The professional players, they know better, and if they don't, they will get caught with all the technology that's on the pitch right now. It's kind of trying to change that culture at the lower levels and at the lower ends.
You're listening to the Tuesday Sports Show, your home for all the latest sports news.
Except football.
That's right, you are back here on URN Sport for our Tuesday Sports Show, where, as we just said, we run through all the bits of news that are going on, except from the world of football. But so now we've had a chat then about what's been going on in the cricketing world. I'm now going to turn our attention towards what's been going on for rugby. So, Rory, you've been keeping up with the story that's been developing there regarding, I believe it's called Gatland's Law, I think you're introducing?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's questioning Gatland's Law that was brought in a few years ago by Wales. So, for those who aren't aware, a few years ago, the Welsh Rugby Union Association brought in a rule, which has kind of seemed to be pushed by head coach Warren Gatland, and the law was that they would only select three Welsh players who are playing their rugby outside of Wales, so kind of overseas. And that didn't include, however, players that were already playing or already contracted to play outside of Wales. It was kind of players who moved out of Wales post the law being brought in. However, they are currently reviewing this law, not to kind of take it away, but they might go to a kind of different system, kind of mirroring what Australia do. So currently Australia have a system where if you've won 60 or more caps or played your domestic rugby in Australia for 7 or more years, you can be selected for the Australian teams if you're playing your rugby outside Australia. And of course, this issue's been a big issue in rugby for quite a few years now, kind of ever since New Zealand started it, saying that we're not going to pick players that are playing rugby outside of New Zealand, no matter their heritage. And then kind of England in the last few years have also mapped this view. Kind of a few of their players, like such as the Armitage brothers or like Nick Abendon, have gone to play their rugby in France, and then England have gone, no, we're not going to pick you, we're playing in France, you've got to be playing your rugby in England. So kind of the question I want to ask you guys today, I want to bring to the floor, is are countries doing the right thing in doing so? Do you think it's a good move for them to be saying you've got to be playing your rugby in our country, or should they be kind of having a more football-esque model where you go, we'll pick you wherever you're playing as long as you're good enough to play, sort of thing?
The thing is, you've got to almost remove New Zealand from the conversation because they've been doing it for decades and their system is just so idiosyncratic on this, you almost have to remove them. But for everyone else, if you're going to have some sort of policy, a policy like the Australian one feels like the best of both worlds, because you don't want to be unnecessarily cutting your nose off to spite your face like England are doing with Stephen Armitage and Nick Abendon. They are doing it for the sake of it, and they're actively leaving out two of the best players in the world. That's not smart. But if you do want to safeguard the quality of your domestic game, you want to keep at least some of them there by law. So you keeping it with that sort of, if you played for a certain amount of years and got a certain amount of caps, so you have a certain amount of seniority, then you can essentially go and get paid what you're worth in the Premiership or the top 14. That's a good compromise measure for both the players and the rugby unions.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, firstly, what you said about New Zealand, is that I kind of think with New Zealand rugby culture, it's so ingrained, not just in sporting culture, but in the way of life, that literally everything in New Zealand resolves by rugby. That's the way it is. They kind of are different. No other country has that. And that's why they can kind of say, well, you've got to be in New Zealand, because they have the resource and they have the attributes to do that sort of thing. But I've just kind of, for me, and I've had this debate so many times over the last 2 or 3 years since England brought this in, I've looked at, I think, Stephen Armitage is the big one.
Yeah,
I reckon.
Yeah, that's the key one.
Maybe not in the last year, but certainly 2 or 3 years ago, he would walk into any back three in the world.
Well, there was, I can't remember which year it was, but one essentially IRB player of the year.
Yeah, so, well, he got man of the match in 2 Heineken Cup finals, and then won IRB player of the year after the second one. It was like he would walk into any rugby team in the world, and yet England are choosing to ignore him. Yeah. And it kind of, I do understand. I mean, I'm not an English rugby fan. I'm Scottish, so I was quite happy they weren't picking him. But the fact is that, like, I just feel that you could just, English rugby has had so much kind of people kind of slagging them off and saying they're not performing as they should be. I know the last 2 years have been good, but before that they weren't doing as good. How can you ignore someone like this? I would just, if it was me, it was my team, I would be crying out to get them in the side.
Well, and if I remember correctly, Stephen Armitage initially moved to France before this rule came into place. So it's kind of unfair on him that he's moved towards being quite good, become a superstar, and yet now, because of that move, he now can't play for his country.
Yeah, I think Eddie Jones's line was that if he really wants to play, he'll come back. But the fact is that I said he got a couple of caps for England, then didn't get picked again, and he went, got offered this fantastic lifestyle, getting paid good money, living in the south of France, playing in probably one of the best teams we've seen in the last maybe 10, 15 years, and that Toulon side. Why, for him, why would you change? Why would you give that up when he kind of had his shot in England, they kind of turned him away and said, well, now I've proved myself, you're not going to pick me?
I think it's really, it's cutting off your nose to spite your face with this, and as an English rugby fan, it is a bit despairing to see Armitage not playing for England. But I think you've got to also think of the bigger picture and think that, would your domestic scene suffer and not be able to produce the same calibre of players if you let all your best players go abroad? And I'm very torn on this, and I can see both sides, but I really understand the logic of trying to have a strong domestic scene to produce the best international team that you can.
Well, I think that's a good point about, I said, on the domestic team, is that, I said, being a Scottish rugby fan, you look at kind of the last 2 years, Scottish rugby has been massively on the up, as it has been kind of for 10 years of depression before that. And I think a massive influence of that was having a good Glasgow team. Having that Glasgow team that said that won the Guinness Pro 12, it said it got to European quarterfinals this year, and it was suddenly like, before that, club rugby in Scotland was rubbish. I used to go and watch Edinburgh, and it was depressing, and they were meant to be the good team out of the two. Like, I think that is a good point. Having that good core of Scottish players in that Glasgow team that's being competitive has been a massive part. So I guess I would annoy me if a player wasn't getting picked, but I can understand why teams are doing it. Kind of go back on myself totally.
That's why
there.
I feel like this sort of measure that Australia have, where you have to have like a lot of caps and have played in the league for a number of years, that's why I feel it's a good compromise measure, because you're still keeping them within the country for a long time. Like Australia at 7 years, that's still a significant time for you to help develop the next wave of players behind you, for you to achieve what you can within the league. But then you can go on, it's being fair to the players, where they can go on and then get paid what they're worth, as opposed to their salaries being artificially held down because they can only play for their country if they're playing in that league.
Yeah, so you're saying that we need a kind of a more progressive way of thinking about it, rather than like a yes or no, kind of like a grey, like you've got to earn your stripes to go abroad.
Hello, this is Jonathan Agnew, and you're listening to URN Sports Show.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Agnew. Yes, you are back here on URN's Tuesday Sports Show with me, Jeremy, Rory and Callum. So we've gone through our chat about what's been happening with rugby and cricket. So now we're going to move on to a bit more. We're going to move on to another topic, which is actually quite topical, obviously, with today being World Mental Health Day. We're going to be talking about the issue. We're starting off small, but we're working up big. Basically, we're starting off with an article that was released the other day by the BBC regarding former hockey English GB hockey player Helen Richardson Welsh, who has talked about how she has had to deal with depression at the moment. Cal, I'm going to throw this one over to you to start us off with the topic about.
With this primarily, it's one where she's had her lowest moment. In this article she's released that she's had her lowest moments when coincided with times of injury. And for someone with depression, this sort of loss of purpose is the absolute worst thing for them, especially when it's a high performance athlete, so their whole life is geared around being able to play this sport. And so it's just really, particularly with Olympic athletes as well, when you're geared your whole life to peak every 4 years, it's, if you got an injury, because I think one was in 2008, so if you have an injury that potentially keeps you out of the Olympics, that's crippling for an Olympic athlete, because that's what your whole life's about. So it's just, but it's also important, as she says, the most important thing for someone with depression is being open about it. That's, speaking from experience, that's how you can get the most power over it, is being open with it, accepting it, and then making it part of your life.
Yeah, I think that's a big point you make, and you talk about it, being open with it is definitely a massive thing. But I think one thing that definitely kind of will contribute to this is the kind of sporting environment, the competitive environment within being in sport. You're kind of thought to be, you have to be really hard, you've got to be really competitive, you can't show any sign of weakness, and kind of opening up and kind of being human can also be seen as unacceptable in that environment. You're kind of showing your flaws, showing your weaknesses, when you're meant to be someone who's so driven, so competitive, doesn't have any weaknesses. You're kind of always trying to iron out those weaknesses. So you kind of let it all bubble up inside. You don't let it escape. You don't let it out. You don't want to speak to your teammates about it, because then they might think, oh, they're not right, they shouldn't be in the team, whatever, rather than being supportive. And people would be supportive, but I think it's just kind of getting out there and getting that common understanding that these things are normal, they are acceptable, and that you aren't being weak for feeling them.
And the other thing with this country as well is that people think of depression as the worst case scenario, that, you know, oh, so-and-so has depression, therefore I can't say anything remotely wrong or they'll go jump off the overpass. So it's kind of letting people know that people with depression are people. They're not crazy. Essentially, so it's letting, so her and other athletes being open about these mental health issues is good for both youngsters who are dealing with these, who are having it, who could they be inspired to take up a sport or inspired to keep in sport, but also just so their teammates can be more open and understanding with them. Because while you might think someone's just a moody person, they might just be having a rough time with a mental illness or a mental health disorder. So it's that key thing of the environment is so important, because you're so driven and trying to be, not show any weakness. It's, you have to be weak sometimes.
Yeah, it is something in sport which I think now is starting to, I think probably compared to how it was 10 years ago now, it is certainly being recognised, I think, a lot more for if you are a sportsman. But I don't think enough is, I think what we were getting at here, it isn't sometimes done enough. Because if, for example, say, you know, you're a young athlete and you're just about to break through and you've got your big moment at, you know, something like the Diamond League, for example, or even if, you know, you get into an Olympic squads team, or, for example, you know, you're a rugby player or cricketer that have just broken through into the side, and then suddenly you get a big injury which could keep you out for several months, that can be so damning to people's mindset, because they'll think, you know, this is my big chance, I've missed it. Like I think you're saying there, Callum. I mean, it, you know, we hear stories quite often about with athletes with athletes and sportsmen and women, as to how sometimes, you know, that slight knock can just knock someone 4-6. Basically, it can send them tumbling down their own mental state, and it is something that is really worrying. I mean, does this fall into kind of the issue of, like, I know, for example, it's something here at the University of Nottingham, we are trying to improve, like, our general issue of welfare in sport. Is it something, like, in general, is a bigger issue, that sometimes when someone gets that injury, it's about that support network around them that then becomes just more key than anything?
Well, the good thing, though, is you're seeing more sports psychologists in these organisations who are then immediately helping them with counselling. Because it's not, even if you have an underlying mental health issue, if you get catastrophically injured, you're going to be on the shelf for a long time. You have to know what to do with yourself, so that you then don't isolate yourself and spiral down into self-loathing and feeling like you're useless. So it's a good progression that we're getting there now, that these sports psychologists are coming in and helping with that.
I think you mentioned sports psychologists there and kind of having structures in place. I think one thing as well we need to be mindful of is that in some sports they're much better in place than others, and kind of more high-profile sports, where I feel that, and obviously it doesn't mean that people in higher profile sports don't get mental health issues, of course they do, but there's probably more understanding, there's more structure in place, there's more money to have those structures in place. But for example, I know in associate cricket, there's a big problem with mental health issues in associate cricket right now, and as well as county cricket. I know this from personal experience, because it's a very hard way of life. You're seen as a professional, you are a professional, and you're employed as a professional, but you don't have the same kind of professional lifestyle or structure as someone who's playing for England or Australia might, because they're playing all year round, they've got cricket all year round, they've got training, where as an associate cricketer for a country, say for example like Scotland, Ireland, something along those lines, is that you'd be fully contracted player, but you might go 6, 7, 8 months without playing an international game, and you're still expected to keep yourself fit, be going to the gym, keep up your training program. Without that kind of end product, you can get lost. And I feel like in all these sports, it's interesting you're talking about a hockey player, again, not such a high-profile sport. In every sport, there needs to be some sort of understanding about what the difficulties are being a professional in that sport, what each individual has, what their circumstances might be, and kind of letting the players know these are the difficulties of being a professional before they come with the professional, and these are the ways we can help you, and these are the ways we can deal with them.